Welcome to That Season Air podcast. I'm your host, Gina. Stick with me as I chat to season airs, expats and adventurers across the world, sharing their inspiring stories and interesting insights into living and working abroad. Get ready for some contagious enthusiasm as I catch up with Canadian legend, the one and only Cody Sheff. Cody shares his season story through Japan and Australia and how leaving his corporate job behind led him on a path that he never dreamed of.
I honestly thought that I was just doing a winter season to get it out of my system so I could get myself straight so I could go back home and go work the corporate thing again without feeling like I missed out. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, I just got to do this one time and I'm going to be okay.
This episode brings you barrels of positivity and miles of motivation as Cody runs us through his experience of splitboarding on an abandoned ski resort, cycling from one end of Italy to the other, and how he ended up living in a cave. If you enjoy the podcast and want to show your support for the show, you are now able to buy me a coffee via the link in the show notes. And without further ado, here's the show. Cody, it is a pleasure to finally meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Gina. A fantastic time.
You were nominated to come on the show by Lauren in episode one, Lauren Lamari. So yeah, thanks for reaching out and getting in touch with me.
Pleasure's all mine.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you originally from and what's your current situation?
Well, I'm from Canada, which is a pretty general term to say. So I would specify that I was born in Calgary. I grew up most of my life in the center of Canada in the prairies around Winnipeg on a farm. I grew up on a farm down there for quite a while. And then I went to university in Winnipeg and did some corporate work in Winnipeg for a little while in the finance industry. And then I moved out to the mountains in British Columbia. And now I'm currently in Italy, currently bike touring through Italy is what I'm doing.
Awesome. And can you just tell the audience where you are currently recording this?
Well, I needed to make a recording studio on the fly. So we've got a tent with some sleeping bags over top of it. And I'm inside of some abandoned building in a field somewhere. It's large and the roof is caved in. So that means I have reception. So that's nice.
We'll have to get a picture of that uploaded for the social media.
I can send you that and a video. You can get you a tour like MTV crib style. I'll do the whole thing.
Yes. Love it. Please, please do. So do you now consider yourself a seasonaire? Because you have been a seasonaire in the past. Is that right?
Yes. I would definitely consider myself as a seasonaire at this point. I've been doing predominantly winter seasons. It's been a little bit more difficult to follow winter around the world nowadays, but I've been doing winter seasons and I guess seasons in general since 2017 would have been the first winter. So December 2017 is the first time that I went.
And has it just been back-to-back seasons since then?
It was quite a bit. I did back-to-back seasons between Japan and Australia for pretty much 3 years. And then because of the pandemic, I had to make a bit of changing on those plans and go back to Canada for a little while. But then I went out, I've just come to Italy this last year to do another winter season, which has been extremely unique in its own way. And now we're here, getting closer to another winter, and I'm going back to do another winter season in Italy.
Awesome. So you say your background was in finance and accounting, is that right? You went to uni or...
I did. I finished high school, went to university when I was 18. I went and I took a business administration degree. So I went straight from high school right into uni. I'd always had a lot of interest in the business world just because, I don't know, it was something that my parents always talked to us about. We ran a farm. So it's like that was being a business owner as well as running a farm. So I was always at the kitchen table hearing about all the different ins and outs of what were going on in our own business and how it changed and how it evolved and where it was coming from. And it was always interesting. So I took a marketing and human resources degree. And with that, ended up in corporate recruiting for a finance and accounting company. So like a third party recruiter, kind of like headhunter, all these different things that you could call it. I think my official job was a staffing manager.
What was it that sparked your interest in living and working abroad in the first place?
Well, I can't really say that it was just like a one thing that really changed my lifestyle from that to where I am now, because it's definitely, it's been a lot of steps from working in a student high to living in abandoned buildings. So, I mean, this that's a far stretch. Definitely wasn't one step at a time. But when I was working as a recruiter, a large part of my job was interviewing people. And I was interviewing people from, 20 all the way to 65 years old. Like, if not older sometimes, like just all over the place. It's from different countries, different backgrounds, different socioeconomic demographics, all sorts of different types of people. And it kind of started as a small idea at first, but it became apparent to me that people weren't really asking me to find them their next job to get them more money. They were asking me to find them the next job that was going to get them more time. They were asking me things like work-life balance or more vacation time or less commute or more time with family or more sick days. Like, it's just, the list goes on and on and on and on. But it just started as a small thing. But after a while, and after listening to all these hundreds and hundreds of people basically telling me the same thing over and over again, it just, I don't know, I couldn't get the idea out of my head. And it just started being like, I'm doing exactly what these people are telling me not to do. Like, I got to get out of here. So I ended up leaving. I quit the job. I didn't have anywhere to go, like any other job to go to. But I, my girlfriend at the time and one of my good friends, Chris John, we decided to move out to British Columbia, mm-hmm. which is about three provinces over. And just figure it out. And we went snowboarding for a while, and then I started bartending, and then one thing led to another, and I started to want to, and then I wanted to go to Japan. So It just kind of went from there.
Yeah, so you started off doing your first season actually in your home country, and then it wasn't until a bit later on that you decided to go a bit further afield.
In a way, actually, what happened is that first winter that I moved out to British Columbia, I wasn't working at all. I had just left my career and I had some savings, and we had found a reasonable apartment, and we just drove up to the mountain every day. I didn't know any of the staff. I didn't know anybody there. It was just me and my girlfriend and my buddy, Chris, just snowboarding all the time. And it was fun. It was really, really fun. And up in Big White is where I was actually. I just got to know that after all this time that I spent snowboarding, I just wanted to go snowboarding. I didn't really care why or what kind of job I needed to do or anything like that. So I never actually had worked a season in Canada. And my first season that I ever did or worked was in Japan, was the next year. Yeah.
So when you left for Big White, did you have any future plans at that point? Or were you just like, I'm going to take some time off and just see what happens?
That's exactly it. So I had quit my career. I had some money and I just wanted to go snowboarding. So I just went out there. I had been to Big White before. I loved it. And it was near Kelowna. So I figured, you know, back in the day, I thought to myself, oh, maybe I'll come back into the HR world again or come back into the business world. So Kelowna was a big enough city. I figured it was a good mix between mountains and city kind of idea. So I just ended up plopping myself there, but it definitely took a big turn after that. That's for sure.
Yeah. So where did you head next? You said you wanted to go to Japan.
I did want to go to Japan. It was kind of a funny idea just because my dad had gone such a long time ago. I think it was like when I was six or something, he had gone out there to do some hardwood flooring. And he always talked about it as being this really cool place. And then we started seeing snowboarding videos of people going to Japan and seeing this endless powder and all this crazy stuff. So I ended up a little bit later on, like, now I was single. I didn't have, I was working as a bartender. I didn't really have anything keeping me in Kelowna. And I had this idea swimming around my head that I wanted to go to Japan. So it was kind of funny because I didn't know anything about going out there. I knew nothing. Like, I didn't know a single person. I didn't know any Japanese. I didn't even know. I've never even worked in a ski resort. I had no clue what I was doing, but I just literally was sitting. I think this was in August of 2017. I was sitting in my apartment and I just went onto Google and I typed in, what's the biggest ski resort in Japan? And I found Niseko. I was like, okay. So like chances are I should be able to find a job in the biggest resort. The next question that I literally typed into Google was how to find a job in Niseko. Like just like that. And then just started doing research. And you know what? The funny thing is within the end of that day, I had sent out two job applications and I got a response back from Niseko Sports, which was a rental place saying, hey, do you want to come work with us? Big respect to those guys because they're the first people that ever gave me a job out in this whole thing.
Oh,
but
wow.
Just like that, within a couple hours, I pretty much had a job in Japan. It was nuts. It was absolutely nuts.
Did you manage to get accommodation or did they sort that out for you? What was your next steps?
That was pretty nice. So basically, after I had found the job, I had to figure out how to actually get to Japan. So then I needed to do working holiday visa applications, which between Canada and Japan, really easy, actually. Simple. It's free, which is pretty cool. It gives you 6 months with possibility to extend, all that kind of stuff. So I got the paperwork out of the way, bought a plane ticket. And thankfully enough, that job, the Niseko Sports Company was actually, or is still, I'm sure, under the umbrella of the actual ski resort. So I got to work for the ski resort. So they had accommodation sorted. They had your transport sorted. They had your, if you wanted your food sorted, like all sorts of things. It was probably one of the easiest season jobs I think you could have possibly popped into because everything was ready. It was, you just had to be there ready to work.
How long were you in Japan for then? Just for 6 months?
I showed up in December or like end of November. You get your training. Basically it's the busiest time of year straight after you show up there, which is like Christmas and New Year's, which that in itself is a pretty hilarious time. Mm-hmm. You're, I don't know, new to this whole world. And then all of a sudden you've got people from every corner of the planet showing up and asking you for different types of skis that you've only seen for the first time in your life. And it was crazy. It was really crazy, but you did the season, which is from December until April or end of April or something like that. And then me and a couple of people that I met there was working with there, which another is a huge advantage to being able to work in a winter season abroad because I didn't know a single person when I showed up there, but the staff of these three rental shops was something like 28 people.
Oh, wow.
So the next day after I started this job, you've got 28 friends or at least 28 people you're going to be introduced to. That was a huge advantage to be able to meet some of those people right away. But the first time I was in Japan, I think I stayed for about 6 months. Yeah, mm-hmm. Something like that. I could not say enough good things about that place. It was incredible.
After Japan, where did you head to next?
That was what was pretty funny. So when I was in Japan, everybody that I was working, well, not everybody, but a lot of the people that I was working with or partying with or meeting while we were out there were from Australia. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of seasonaires there from Australia that were basically, you know, during their, like it's opposite summer, winter kind of thing. So they would go up to Japan and then they were actually talking to me about how they were going back down to Australia to do the next winter season.
Right.
And I mean, I honestly thought that I was just doing a winter season to get it out of my system so I could get myself straight so I could go back home and go work the corporate thing again without feeling like I missed out. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, I just got to do this one time and I'm going to be okay.
That's like the classic situation for all of us. I don't know anyone who's like, I'm just going to do this forever. It's always just, I'm just going to do one and just see how it goes.
I'm just going to do one of them.
And then I'm going to settle down.
I don't know. I settled up. I'm settling up now as far as what I'm concerned. This feels much better than settling down. I met a whole bunch of just great, great people and they were all from Australia and they were telling me they were going down to Hotham. Mm-hmm. And oh man, it's a long story. I met this one guy on a train and on my first day in Japan. And then I'm seeing that he was in Niseko and he ended up giving me this like part-time job as a security guard at a bar. So I was working as a security guard as a bar as well as my rental job in Niseko. And through that guy, I ended up meeting the owners and they were super friendly. And one of the guys, like, it's just, this is how it all went. Like, it was just, you meet one person, you meet the next person, you meet the next person. And then through these last guys, and his name was Steve. And I actually was talking to him at the bar one day, and it was near the end of the season, my first season in Japan. And I was telling him, like, oh, I'm really hoping to go down to Hotham in Australia. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, I have a bar in Falls Creek. If you want to come work in Falls Creek, he's like, you could have a job for sure. And like, oh man, like, Steve, I'm really sorry, but I want to go to Hotham. Like, I really appreciate your thought process here, but everybody I know is going to Hotham. So I think I'd rather go there. He's like, yeah, I understand. And he actually sent a message on Facebook to this other guy he knows called Steve, Sooty. We'll call him Sooty to keep it separate. And the next day I got a message from Sooty saying, hey, I heard Steve said you're a good guy. So do you want to come work down here? And just like that, bang, I had another job in Australia.
Oh my God.
It was just crazy. I couldn't believe it. So then I ended up going to Australia. Well, not right away. I had to fly back to Canada and I dealt with some more visa stuff because, like, mm-hmm. Canadians, you really just got to continuously get the visas because, you know, mm-hmm. that's just how it is. But at least we have them. At least we have the opportunities to have these things, which is kind of nice. Yeah. But then did another visa application and then flew down to Australia 3 weeks later after I flew back from Japan.
That's
three
mad.
Weeks later, bang. Down to Australia to a brand new place to more snow. And I was just like, this is the coolest thing in the world. There's snow again. Oh, it was so cool.
So you headed down to Australia. What was that experience like? Did you enjoy it there?
I absolutely loved it. Like, I mean, you're going to hear me. I'm going to sound like a broken record. I'm going to tell you over and over and over again how many times I love this stuff, but that's why I'm still doing it. That's the whole reason why. I ended up, I got to go work at this bar called The General, and it was so cool. It was just this place that had been around for years, and they had all this history in this town. And, like, Hotham is a really interesting ski resort because it's all on the top of the mountain. Like, it's the ski lifts bring you back up. You don't ski down to the bottom of the chairlift and then it brings you back up type deal.
Oh, wow.
But, I got work as a bartender there. And when you work as a bartender in a ski resort, you get to know a lot of people really quite quickly. And I it was incredible. Like, the culture was incredible. The community was really, really amazing. The snow was actually really good. We everybody kind of laughs about, you're from Canada. Why would you go to Australia to go do a snow season?
Yeah.
And there's no snow in June and July in Canada. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe up on the glaciers, which is, it's a hike to get up there, but it's just not the same. But I went down to Australia. I thought it was amazing. I mean, you could go, there was snow gums and all different trees, and the mountains themselves look fantastic. And the snow is, like, kind of heavy. So even 10 centimeters is almost a pow day as far as I'm concerned. Like, that was, it was, wow. It was sick.
Yeah.
Really, really sick. They party though. Holy moly. Those Australians, they really know how to give her.
They certainly do.
I think I needed to train myself to be able to keep up with those guys sometimes.
How does it fare, Canada to Japan to Australia, in terms of going out?
Oh man, I think Japan probably has the most out of control drinking culture I've ever seen in my life. To be honest. It's incredible for such a organized and like really well structured society in certain ways. Those people really know how to knock back some drinks. It's incredible. Really, really amazing. Like, you can go to the bar until 7 in the morning. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't matter. If you're still drinking, they're still serving you. I just, that was nuts. And Australia is just a whole different can of worms, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing that I have to say about those two, if I was to compare Japan and Australia to Canada, maybe this is just ski resorts that I'm talking about right now, but mm-hmm. it just seemed very accepting to a lot of different people. You know, like, it didn't matter where you were from if you were in Australia. Like, you were still part of the party. And the same thing out in Japan. Like, you were almost like a, I don't know, tourist attraction in some of those bars sometimes. Yeah. When you go up there, you know what I mean? Like,
I find that as well. Like, you go to a lot of bars and meet some of the locals and stuff. It is almost like funny for them to see the different ways we behave and the different drink cultures of each nationality, I suppose.
That is so true. It's so true.
It's interesting for them, I think.
It's definitely a way of exploring different cultures, is just go to a bar and see how everybody acts.
So after Australia, where did you head to next?
I headed back to Japan. I had the fantastic luck. Again, this is why I give so much credit to these guys at Niseko Sports, because they actually sponsored me to be able to come back. Canadians, we only get one working holiday visa in Japan, and maximum that would give you 1 year. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't have given me enough time to be able to go do a second season. So I ended up going to do a second season out there working for the rental shop. I also picked up another job as a bartender at this bar called Tamashi up in Niseko again. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic. And it's really crazy because there's something different about being a first-time staff in a ski resort and then being return staff at a ski resort. Like it really is a different feeling altogether. Like when you first show up, everything's really new and you kind of take a lot of, you spend a lot more money than you need to because you just don't know all the different tricks and things that you could possibly save cash on. And it was just totally different. I mean, the first season though that I was in Japan, mm-hmm. we had something, I don't know, 16 or 17 meters of snow for the year. It was insane. I had never seen anything like that. It was crazy. And then the next season after that was not quite as much snow, but again, a fantastic experience working at the rental shop with and already knowing what I was doing, knowing a lot more of the ski area around there too, being able to do a lot more backcountry, being able to do a lot more filming and kind of getting into a little bit more of like the taking photos, being in photos, riding for that kind of thing. I also got sponsored with the riding team at the shop as well for a little while. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, wow. So they just kind of picked you up to do that, did they? Since you were working for them?
Yeah, there was a couple of the other guys that were working there that kind of were part of the shop team, I guess they would say. And then I ended up kind of approaching them and saying, hey, can I be a part of this as well? Like I had a little bit of an Instagram following at the time, like not huge, but just something. And I just figured I could see if I could leverage that to just get a little bit more. And they brought me on for the year while I was there, which was pretty cool. I had picked up a snowboard sponsor from Australia, which was kind of funny just because, I don't know, long story, but the guy stayed in my apartment while I was in Australia. And then he ended up being like, hey, yeah, let's sponsor you, throw you some boards your way. So all of a sudden, after two seasons, like this was not big time sponsors by any means, but I had somebody giving me free snowboards. I had our shop giving me some stuff. And like, I don't know, it was pretty cool. It felt pretty awesome. I mean, I never could have expected that was going to happen. But that was my second season in Japan. It wasn't quite as long. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to fly back to Canada again. And as I'm going to basically continue, I was going back to Australia. And this time, instead of just working as a bartender, I was going to be working as a manager at that same bar. So I was doing the loop between Japan and Australia, back to Japan and back to Australia. But this time I didn't want to go to Canada. So a couple of us just decided that we would fly to the Philippines instead and just go spend a month in the Philippines, because it was actually cheaper for me to go there and stay there for a month and then to continue flying down to Australia than it would have been for me to fly to Canada, live there for a month, and then fly to Australia. That was pretty fun.
Yeah. How was that experience? Where did you go in the Philippines?
I went to one island. I was trying to keep things simple. I didn't want to make things so crazy of just traveling. I was tired. I mean, this is the problem with these seasons in Japan and these seasons in like, it's exhausting. Yeah. It's exhausting. The nightlife, the working, the snowboarding. Like, I kept making this joke that I was doing 8 day weeks. 8 day weeks. And my thought process behind an 8 day week was that if I don't sleep too much, the amount of time that I'm not sleeping basically adds up to a day every week of being awake.
Oh my goodness.
So I was like, I've got 8 day weeks now. This is fantastic value. Problem was, it's not sustainable for one. Mm-hmm. For two, you don't really remember very much because you're just not sleeping enough. So that, I can't say it was healthy. It wasn't healthy, but it made for some good times and memories that people have reminded me of, which is really good to have friends that are like that. That's always really good. And I wanted to just chill out. So we went to this island called Siargao, which is where I think it's one of the surf breaks that if people know surf, they might know of this one. It's called Cloud Nine. Mm-hmm. and lots of cool surf around that place. And it was like kind of semi-developed, I'd say, a semi-developed area where it was starting to become touristy, but it wasn't too bad. So it was still relatively cheap and the food was still pretty cheap. There was a lot of cool. I don't surf at all. I mean, I tried really hard for a couple times. I went and got some lessons, and that was easy. I couldn't believe it. When you get the lessons, the guy's pushing you along and you can stand up no problem. Everything's great. I was like, oh man, this is great. I'm a natural at this. So we ended up taking a boat out to a really nice break that wasn't far off. And oh man, Gina, I think I spent 3 hours paddling and 30 seconds standing on that board.
Yeah, I had a similar experience to that.
Exhausting. Oh man. And then I got a sunburn. Like, I'm a pretty white, fair-skinned guy, you know, like I've got red hair and I lived for the last 2 years in the mountains. Like, I hadn't seen sun in ages. And then all of a sudden I'm out there in the ocean and the salt and I'm trying to put on layers and layers of sunscreen. Oh man, I don't know. The surf thing. I can see how it would be fun. I can really understand, but I don't know. It might not be for me. Maybe not yet. I don't know. Maybe. We'll see.
I feel exactly the same way. It looks great. And when people can stand up on a board, it looks fantastic.
Oh, man, you should have seen the 8-year-old beside me. He was crushing it.
Yeah, no, it's not for me. All that effort paddling out to try and catch a wave and then you miss it or you fall off. No, it's not for me.
Oh, man. Oh, it was exhausting.
Give me a mountain, you fall over, you get back up, all done.
Absolutely. The way that I kind of compared it to snowboarding is I was like, it's like if you fall, you just have to go all the way back down to the bottom and get on the chairlift again.
Yeah.
Like that's what it felt like. Every time you fall, you don't get a second chance. Like, nope. And you might actually get blown down by, again, like the rest of the set. That's what really freaked me out. It really freaked me out. Like, you're doing everything's just fine. It all seems all hunky-dory. You try to get up on your board. You fall. You're like, oh, it's going to be okay. But there's 6 more waves coming to push you down under the water again. Spin in your face after you fell down. Oh.
Oh. Yeah.
It was still a good month, though. It was a good month. I spent a lot of time in the hammock. It was really, really, really hot. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. It was relaxing. Spent some time having some drinks with some people. Met a lot of really cool people. And then just kind of got into the right headspace to get back into Australia. And that was really sick. Just went back to Oz, did another snow season out there. I mean, I can't really say it's rinse and repeat because every single one of them is different. You end up with different people all the time. You have different stories. You have different, just the whole works. And I mean, working as a manager instead of a bartender, that was a different experience in itself. Mm-hmm. That was fun.
Yeah.
And then I had the idea, because I had already done 2 seasons in Japan and 2 seasons in Australia, I had the idea that I wanted to go to Italy because it was something different and it was just a new set of mountains and another language that I couldn't understand. So I figured, why not do that and be lost again for a while? I originally was going to hope to go to Italy, but I had left early in my last season of Australia and I wasn't going to be able to be there for the staff party at the end of the year, which is like at the end of the year, everybody comes together for like 3 days of, you know,
getting messy.
Yeah, exactly. Where you need a bath afterwards, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
Bath and a month in the Philippines.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And try to so you can remember something again. I wasn't going to be able to make it to this staff party because I had left a few weeks early, which was sad, but I had to go home for a wedding and it was for a really good friend of mine. And mm-hmm. I mean, I don't necessarily condone flying around the world all the time for people's weddings. But if it's an important person and they want you there, you should be there.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, I get this phone call from one of the guys that was working there while I was back in Winnipeg. So I was back in Winnipeg at this wedding. This mm-hmm. was maybe 2 weeks after I'd come back to Canada. And he said, Cody, we've all put some money together and we've bought you a plane ticket to come back to Australia for the staff party.
Oh my God. Like,
serious. You can't be serious. The staff at the bar, all the people that I was working with,
skipped in
and bought me a plane ticket back, which was just some of the nicest things I've ever, like, oh man, my heart was overflowing with joy.
Yeah.
Overflowing. It was incredible. It was really cool. Definitely worth it. Definitely worth it. And it was really, really quite nice as well, because I got to go back there and see my partner, Bonnie. I had met her in Australia in that second season. It was really nice to be able to go back there, because we were kind of starting off. We weren't quite sure what was going on, but I got to go back for 3 weeks more in Australia, which was excellent.
That's so cool.
Oh, it was really neat, and spent some time out that way. But at this point now, it had brought us, like, you want to fast forward a little bit, and it had brought me to middle of October, getting closer to November. I didn't have any time to get this Italian visa thing sorted out anymore.
Right. Okay.
So that train had sailed. Mm-hmm. And I had a good friend of mine that I had managed with in Australia that just basically said, hey, come work with me again in Japan. So I went back to Japan. But it's funny, because that's actually when I went to Nozawa Onsen, and that's where I met Lauren, and that's how I ended up even getting introduced to this show in the first place, which is excellent.
Cool. So you went back to Japan. How is your Japanese at this point?
It's good enough to order some food, to like make people laugh, to maybe flirt with girls a little bit, like very minimal. And it's probably even worse now. It's even worse now. Nihongo wakarimasen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I don't know what you said, but it sounded great. It
just means that I don't understand Japanese.
Oh, okay. So you're in Japan. You've had another season in Japan. How was that?
That season was actually completely different, because instead of working in a giant ski resort like Niseko, which is essentially like, if you want to compare it, it's like the Whistler or the Chamonix of Japan. Like, mm-hmm. It's big. It's really quite large. Yeah, I went from working in that to Nozawa Onsen, which is a much smaller resort, completely different feel in the town, a lot more traditional. You've got like actual bathhouses, like your onsens. There's all over the town. Like, my accommodation that I had to sort out, it didn't even have a shower. Like, you had to use the bathhouse. You had to use that kind of stuff. Like, that just, it's,
oh, wow.
It was just part of it. That was kind of an interesting experience. So you get to go into these onsens, and these things are hot, like 50 degrees. The water's like 50 degrees Celsius. Most like hot tubs in Canada are like 40 degrees Celsius, maybe 42 if you find a hot one, mm-hmm. that someone's turned the dial under the breaker panel, because you can't actually turn it up legally that high. But these things are like just natural spring water, and they're toasty. Oh man, really, really, really cool. I enjoyed that a lot.
So after Japan, where were you heading this time?
Well, that's the funny thing, is I was hoping to get back to Australia, because I still had a little bit of working holiday visa left there, and I was going to just kind of use up the last of it and mm-hmm. spend as much time as I could with Bonnie. We were still from different countries, and she had come to Japan to visit me, and then I was going to go back down to Australia to spend some time with her. That's actually when this whole pandemic thing started, is when I was in Nozawa.
Right.
And it was very interesting, because I remember when I first started hearing about it, people were, I don't really keep up with current events very much. I'm not very good at watching the news.
Same, yeah.
But when I was in Japan, some people started talking to me about this corona thing, and I actually had no clue what they were talking about. I had no idea, no idea. And then they're like, well, haven't you heard about this sickness that's come out of China? I was like, there's no way anything like that's going to ever add up to anything. Like, there's people get sick in China all the time. I was very wrong. I was very, very wrong. It's something definitely happened. It was very interesting, actually. In Japan, I can't say that it was horribly tight. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't super restrictive. I guess at the time they were still trying to have the 2020 Olympics in 2020 in Japan. So I think that mm-hmm. probably had something to do with it, that they didn't, you know, lock everything down completely. I had heard somebody told me that because of what happened after the war, they never really wanted to like impose these types of super restrictive rules on their people anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was actually a reasonably calm experience over there. The craziest thing that happened was everybody from Australia that was working in that ski resort, which was quite a few, just everybody just left. Everybody took the first flights they could pretty much and went home, which basically made that the ski season ended a month early. It just felt like the end of a season. Like, you know how the end of a season feels like.
Yeah.
The whole town kind of becomes almost abandoned, but not quite. There's always like a few stragglers and you have a few people hanging at the one bar. Like, it's just everything's gone from like really crazy to just no one's left.
Yeah.
And it was the same. It actually never really felt different to me. It just felt normal. It felt just like the season ended a month early. When it really started changing is when I couldn't go to Australia anymore. So they had locked their borders. Canada locked their borders to everybody except for obviously Canadians. So I couldn't go to Australia to see Bonnie. She couldn't come to Canada to see me. So we just decided to stay in Japan for another 3 months. We just stayed in Japan. She's like, what else? What else are we going to do? There's no work in Canada. There's no work in Australia. Like, everything's closed. Why not just stay here? The craziest part was when we ended up in Tokyo. This was when I had to fly home, because eventually I did need to fly home because I needed to do something. I can't just stay in Japan forever. We went to Tokyo and we went to that Shibuya crossing, you know, the one that's in all the videos and the movies, like all those people crossing the road at the same time in Tokyo. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was there in the morning. So this was not peak season, but in the morning and not peak time, but it was like, it was empty. I've never seen that before. I've been to Tokyo a few times now, and that crossing has thousands of people in it. Thousands. Like, it's crazy. And that morning, there was like no one there. I was like, whoa, this is different. This is definitely different. This is something I haven't seen before. So that was kind of weird. I went back to Canada, and the airports were all kind of abandoned, and everybody was kind of wearing hazmat suits, and that was pretty interesting. That was very, very different.
Was Bonnie able to go with you at that point?
No. So that's when we actually got separated. So I had to go back to Canada. She had to go back to Australia, but she couldn't find a flight actually, because we had stayed there for so long. She couldn't find a flight until, I think, July. Mm-hmm. So it was almost a month after I had left that she finally managed to get back to Australia. But that's when the idea of mine to go to Italy came in my head again. Which was pretty funny, because Italy was known as like the worst place for a long time. It was one of the hardest hit, and everything was kind of going south. But I don't know. I've been told a few times in my life, when everybody's running one way, maybe run the other way. So I had it in my head that maybe we could go to Italy. And by this time, it was in the summer of 2020. Everything was kind of relaxing a little bit. We did our research, and Italy was allowing people from both Canada and Australia to go there for tourist reasons. So we applied for our working holiday visas on both respective sides. So like, Bonnie did it on her end, I did it on my end. I ended up working with my parents for a little while. We had done some work in construction. I'd done some work in construction here and there kind of all through my life. Done a lot of jobs, Gina, a lot of different random jobs. But I was working on this house at my parents, and the summer was eating up. Like, the summer was chewing up, and then we were getting into fall, and then things started getting a little bit more out of control again with the pandemic, and then restrictions starting tightening up. So I'm checking the news all the time, and I hate checking the news, and I'm checking the news all the time, looking at like how the Italian laws have changed and if they're blocking any countries out, if they're allowing any more countries to stay in, and all these different things. And so far, everything was okay. Basically, by the beginning of December, everything had still been fine. We both had our visas at this point. Everything was all well and good. I remember the guy that asked me when I was applying for my visa, he's like, why are you doing this now? Like, why are you applying for a working holiday visa now? I was like, well, because I need to go. I need to go out there. He's like, you're crazy, but you're not doing anything illegal, so it's fine. And I think it was the first week of December, Italy had changed their laws. And because Canada's situation was no longer as good as it was, they blocked Canada from coming in. So Canada was no longer allowed to go to Italy, but Australia still was, which was very stressful. So now I was reading through all of the different exceptions and all the different rules and all the different things that you could do to get into. And they had this big list of things that you could still use as an excuse to get into Italy. I didn't have a job yet. I didn't have an apartment yet. I didn't have anything. Like, we didn't, this was again, another one of these, just, I'm going to Italy. I'll figure it out when I get there kind of things. I ended up kind of using a weird loophole. One of the things that it said that you could get in with is, it was a clause in there, said of absolute necessity. So, I mean, I wrote this big giant letter saying how it was absolutely necessary for me to go there, but I didn't think it was enough to stand on.
Yeah.
So I ended up going through Workaway. You've heard of Workaway before?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be interviewing a Workaway tomorrow, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. So I never really had heard of Workaway before, and I looked it up. And in Italy, you're not allowed to volunteer unless you have a visa, right? Like, it's one of the, it's, and I'm sure a lot of countries are like that, where you technically need to have a working visa if you're going to go volunteer somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how often it's patrolled, but that's the loophole I was going to use. Mm-hmm. And basically, I had set up this volunteer position at this organic kind of permaculture farm thing in Italy for May. So after the winter season. And I got the guy to just send me a letter that said, Cody will be staying with us for an indeterminate amount of time in 2021. That's all it said. That's all this letter said in Italian, and he signed it. I was basically getting on the plane in Vancouver, and I had this really minimal letter and this gigantic letter that I had basically said that I'm going to meet my long lost love from Australia because it's the only place that I can get there, and I've already sold all my stuff and I have no job in Canada. I went on and on and on. It was a sob story. I could have got an Academy Award for that letter.
They love the romance of it though.
They love
very
that
Romeo
stuff.
And Juliet.
Exactly. These people are passionate. So I was trying to give them as much Canadian fiery passion as I could without saying too many stories, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I go to Vancouver and I've got no idea if I'm going to get into this country. I had a very small leg to stand on, if any. The person at the desk was like, you got to make sure you have all your paperwork because they're turning people around at the airport if it's not in order. I'm like, yep, I've got everything. I've got everything I need. And they're like, okay, all right, get going. I get onto the plane and I fly to Brussels, and then I get to Brussels and they've asking me all these different questions, and you've got to fill out all these declarations and you have to tell them where you're going and where you've come from. And, like, you know, all this different protocol for the quarantining and stuff. And I was telling them I was going to Italy, and they're like, okay, do you have all your papers? And yet again, everybody's asking me if I have all my papers, if I have all my papers. And I'm stressed. Like, I am stressed, Gina. I cannot explain to you how stressed I was. And I finally get on this last flight and I show up to Italy. And this is the moment of truth. You know, you're walking up to that guy after this big, long, snaky lineup of people of going back and forth. And you show up there and I've got this big stack of papers and my passport and, like, my self-declaration form. And he's just like, I'm standing in front of him and he's in Italian. He's just like, he asked me for my passport. I give him my passport. And then he asked me for the self-declaration form. I give him the self-declaration form. And then he's like, are you working here? I was like, yes. He's like, what are you doing? And I said, contadino, which means farmer. And he let me go. That was it. That was it. My entire experience of coming into Italy hinged on one word, contadino. And that was it. And I was in.
Amazing.
Problem
Perfect.
Solved.
Got there in the end.
Thankfully, like, the second I got through, I didn't quite believe it at first, actually. I went and picked up my luggage and I was kind of waiting for one more person to, like, check my papers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just walked out and I was just out in the front of the airport. I got to send Bonnie a message while she was still within, like, not on her own flight, because she was flying somewhere from Australia, still not knowing if I was going to be in the country either.
Oh my God.
And I got to message her and be like, I'm in, don't worry. She's like, I'm just about to get on my last flight. I'm so happy to hear that.
That's amazing. Yeah.
That was pretty wild.
Yeah.
It was definitely nerve-wracking. And she showed up a day later. So I just waited in the airport for 23 hours, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a private transfer because you needed a private transfer. And then we went and quarantined for 2 weeks, which was kind of fun, in a little place called Varallo Sesia. I went from the region of Lombardy to Piemonte. Mm-hmm. We stayed there. And I only had 1 month of Airbnb booked. That was the only plan because we needed at least 2 weeks of it to quarantine. And then I figured we could use the rest of the 2 weeks to, I don't know, figure out what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. In that month that we were in Piemonte, kind of like just through the internet world, you know, I'd asked if anybody knew anybody in Italy, if anybody had any contacts of any places. And I really wanted to go to this mountain called Monte Rosa. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons was it just got so much backcountry opportunity out there. It's incredible. The other reason is it's not such a central hub of a town. You know what I mean? Like it's mm-hmm. a lot of little towns kind of broken up. So I knew that the nightlife wasn't going to be so crazy.
Yeah.
So I could relax. Spend more time snowboarding and less time partying all the time. So like we didn't really know what we were going to do because I had no accommodation, no anything. But we ended up finding through Facebook and just like, I guess, scraping through the internet, we found an apartment. So we rented a car and we went and looked at the apartment. This was after we were finished quarantine, up in Champoulec in Monte Rosa. Mm-hmm. And we found it up there and we were asking this woman some questions like, what is the season going to be like? Like, is it going to be like, where do you think is a good place to find work? And she's basically like, well, I don't even know if the season's going to happen. And that was a bit of a shock because from the news that we were reading, they were like, oh, January 7th, the season's going to start. We were just kind of banking on that because we had been in quarantine and waiting in this place till basically January 5th or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we'd finally gotten out there. We were hoping that this was going to start. And long story short, the season never actually happened.
No.
We were living in an apartment in Champoulec and we just decided to stay anyway. We didn't work. We just would take the bus down to the nearest town to go grocery shopping every, I don't know, once every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And we just split boarded up the mountain every day,
wow,
which was awesome. We got to ride on an abandoned ski resort for like 3 months. That's incredible. When do you ever get to experience the Alps with no one on it? Like yeah, that was nuts. That was crazy.
That must be quite hard work though, hiking up to do a couple of runs.
Yeah, one run, pretty much one run. There was a few days that we decided to do a couple runs, but it was tough. It was quite the adjustment period to get used to getting up that hill. I think it was, I don't know, 1,200 meters. I think you'd do 1,200 meters of ascent in something like 6 or 7 kilometers to get to the top from where we were.
And how long did that take you?
Well, it depends on who you were with. So mm-hmm. like when we were a bigger group, it would be, I don't know, maybe 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. At first, when we first started, it was probably closer to 3 hours. But I mean, if you were really charging up there, like I remember there was a couple of us that were kind of feeling like we would get into a competition and try to get up as fast as we possibly could. And we saw some of these like ski mountaineering guys on these tiny little breadstick skis go up there. And the one dude told me he went up there in 58 minutes. I'm like, 58 minutes? That's insane. That is insane. But like, it's a whole different sport. I had this giant split board underneath my feet and probably not nearly as much cardiovascular health as that young man did. But I think the fastest I ever made it up was like an hour and 25 minutes or an hour and 26 minutes or something like that, which was pretty good. I was quite proud of myself.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was amazing. Honestly, it really made you appreciate every run a little bit more. It made it that much more special mm-hmm. To be able to explore a mountain on foot.
Yeah.
It was really, really amazing.
That's incredible.
And it was something I kind of started getting into while I was in Japan and also in Australia. And I kind of, yeah, I brought a little bit more in this backcountry touring with the split boarding and I guess how people say like earn your turns or however you want to say it. Mm-hmm. I love it. I really, really, really love it. I think it's a fantastic way to experience the mountains.
That's so cool. You should check out Dark Starts podcast. Maybe you should be on there. You should go on there as a guest.
I'll go talk to him 100%. I'll be like, hey, do you guys want to listen to this monologuist for a while? Like, you got some time. I got more time than you do. I guarantee it.
Oh my God. They're so cool. They're super cool. And yeah, they've got this really cool podcast where they just literally talk about backcountry and splitboarding.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So yeah, you're doing a lot of backcountry and splitboarding in Italy. How did it fare compared to sort of Australia, Japan? I think over here in Europe, we're not as well renowned for the depths of snow.
It's funny because I can't compare apples to apples because I was able to ride a lot of fresh powder because there was no one there to touch it.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. And the other crazy thing about this was that we had it easy. This was about as easy as you could possibly get it because this ski resort was ready to open.
Wow.
The runs were groomed. The runs were still being groomed. So we could walk up groomed runs and then ride down groomed runs if we wanted to, or ride backcountry runs if we wanted to. It was pretty amazing. I'd say a big difference between, well, like everything was quite different. Like riding in Australia, you have heavier snow, little bit less elevation, but where I was, it was quite steep. Yeah, the snow quality is different, a lot of warmer temperatures kind of thing. Riding in Japan, you can never see anything because it's always snowing. So it's always kind of that whiteout stuff, but you have that dry, deep powder, very low elevation mountains. You have trees almost all the way up to the top of most of them. But then riding here in Italy, I was living at 1,600 meters and you'd walk up to 2,600, 3,000, 3,500, wherever, however far you wanted to go. It's really interesting to ride the entire time in the Alpine above the trees. Mm-hmm. That was really different for me. And lots of sunny days, like really, really great sunny days. It was completely different to anywhere that I've ridden before, for sure. But amazing, all in its own way. That's one of my favorite parts about traveling around the world and riding on all these different types of snow and all these different mountains is that they truly are different. You wouldn't think, but they actually are. It was
so
fun.
Cool. So you're still in Italy now?
Yeah.
What are you doing at the moment? Tell us what you're doing still in Italy. The pandemic is, I mean, we're still amongst it, but things have got a lot easier at the moment.
Things really have gotten easier. So basically, by the end of I quite mean literally winter season this time, because it's not like any work was ending. We were like, well, what do we do now? Like, I haven't worked. Bonnie hasn't worked. We don't have any more money. Like, we have some savings that we were using, but we don't have any more money. And there was that workaway that I had organized before I got there.
Yeah.
So we knew that we were going to go do that workaway in May, but we just didn't really know what we were going to do afterwards. So I remember we were sitting in our apartment one day and we figured, why not just look at workaway and see if, you know, there's something else to go do and see if there's any other opportunities. We were looking through and Bonnie found this one that this guy was asking for some people to work at a hostel. We applied for it and he responded to us really quickly. And this hostel was in San Vito Lo Capo, which is, we didn't know this at the time, but we looked like, well, where is San Vito Lo Capo? And we look at it on the map and it's on the far west side of Sicily. So pretty much as far as we could possibly get from where we currently were in the Valle d'Aosta, all the way in the north of Italy. So we've agreed to this workaway for July to go work for a month in this hostel. So like workaway is like in exchange for food and lodging. So we get to stay there and live there for free kind of thing. So we now knew that we needed to get from the north of Italy all the way to the south of Italy and into Sicily. Our friends that we had made while we were in Champoluc during the winter season had told us about their bike touring that they had been doing.
Right.
It seemed like a really crazy idea to me when they first started telling me about it, to be honest. Like putting all these bags on a bicycle and cycling for thousands of kilometers to me just seemed like an absolutely crazy idea.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it was. But after a while, we were talking about it. I'm pretty sure Bonnie was the one that decided to say it. But I'm pretty sure she was just like, why don't we bike there? And yeah, it kind of, again, one of these things of like one thing leads to another. And we decided to go do the workaway in May. So we went to do this organic farming workaway. The guy that gave me the letter to get into Italy in the first place. Fantastic guy, him and his partner. Fantastic. I mean, if anybody wants to go do that workaway, I think you should. It's fun. It was a good time. We went and did that. And then we, we organized our trip. So we ended up buying two used mountain bikes from the basement of one of the hotels that was in Champoluc. They were for like 50 euro, I think it was, for both of them.
So you're literally talking push bikes, not even e-bikes.
Oh yeah, push bikes. But e-bikes would be a horrible idea to do long distance travels. Where would you charge them? And then you just have a heavy bike after a day.
That's true.
That would be way harder, way harder. Maybe unless, I don't know, maybe some people can do it, but I couldn't even see how it would be done. But we bought these two bikes. They needed a lot of work. They needed a lot of work. But we found all the parts and ordered some parts and got some racks and had some help from our good friend Robin and Ruth. And they helped us out and gave us lots of advice. And then we just started biking south.
Wow.
And we biked all the way. It was, I think, 2,000 kilometers from Champoluc to San Vito Lo Capo, and it was 2,000 plus because we got lost a few times. I don't know how to calculate that. But yeah, it was a long way. It took us a month.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. 2,000 miles on a push bike. That's impressive. Well done.
Yeah, we biked all the way to our next workaway, which was all of June. So we biked all of June. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It was one of the craziest ways to experience a country. I mean, we went all along the West Coast, like to Genova and Cinque Terre, and you get to go into Pisa and Lucca into Rome and into Naples and into the Amalfi Coast and all these things.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
Absolutely beautiful.
Breathtaking. So that's what we did. That's what we did. And that's actually funny because that's what we're still doing now. But we went and worked that work away, right?
Yeah. How was it?
Fantastic. Fantastic. We were working at this hostel called Timbuktu Hostel. Mm-hmm. Crazy place. One of the nicest hostels I've ever seen in my life. Like amazing. Amazing. Like really, really, really nice. Like the kitchen looked like it was a modern kitchen. Everything was amazing. Like the mattresses were nice and the art was amazing. Like it was like a rich Italian that has been traveling a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, you have like art from Africa and art from all over the place. Like he would basically bring in people on Workaway just to do art pieces.
Oh, wow.
So like this place is full of all sorts of different kinds of art and it's got a climbing wall and I could go on and on and on, but it was an incredible experience working out there. We met hundreds and hundreds of people because it's a nonstop revolving door of people coming in and out of that place. And San Vito Lo Capo, little did I know, because I'd never heard of the place before, but it was it's like a beach resort town kind of thing where it's like a lot of Italian tourists that come down there, a lot of tourists kind of from all over the place. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. And during this time, so this is like, while we were still down there, we were applying for a permesso di soggiorno, which is our residency permit here in Italy. Because even if we have a working holiday visa, you still need to apply for your residency permit regardless.
Right.
And it's quite the process to get this thing. Italian bureaucracy is an art. It's more art than science, I think. Definitely not what I was used to when I came from Japan, where everything is sorted like at the airport gate.
Yeah.
Everything's done. But no, definitely not like that.
Not in Italy. Very laid back about getting things. There's no rush. Ooh, no
is
rush.
Is it ever laid back? Is it ever? I have never seen something so laid back in my life. But I love it. I kind of love it. It's funny. Like it's like it comes with all its own bonuses. It's like, well, if it's taking this long for the process to happen, mm-hmm. obviously I'm not doing anything wrong being here.
Exactly.
So that's fine. Take as much time as you want. I don't care. I'm just going to keep staying until you give me an answer.
Yeah.
So we started this process sometime in January. And at this point, it's August and still nothing. They had lost some of our papers. Like, I don't know whose fault it is. This maybe is no one's fault. Who knows? Human error. Shit like this happens once in a while.
They're just chilling hard.
Yeah, of course. And we had to restart. So we restarted this process in Trapani. And this was the end of our work away now. So there's some new volunteers coming in. They've no longer got any room to keep hosting us. I mean, like he let us stay on like in the area on the roof in our tent for a little while. Like guy, still letting us use all of the accommodation stuff. Like
that's
no
so
worries.
Nice. Yeah.
But he came up with the idea. He's like, I know of this cave. And we're like, okay, tell us more. And basically something like an 8-minute bicycle ride away from the hostel was this cave.
Cave,
like in the cliff cave, rock formation.
Right.
Natural, you know, hut. And we moved into the cave. Long story short, we looked it up. We thought it was cool. We got in there and it's like, this is perfect. This is absolutely perfect.
It's amazing.
Set up everything nice in there. We got some kind of carpets on the ground and we set up our tent because you want to have a barrier from all the critters while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
Like when I'm awake, it's okay. But when you're sleeping, I don't know. I don't trust them.
No.
I don't know what they're going to be doing. But it was amazing. And it's probably the only way that we could have possibly survived in that place for that long. Because we were waiting now for this permesso di soggiorno to come through. Mm-hmm. And they said it was going to be another month. So we were going to have to stay in San Vito Lo Capo for one more month. And I couldn't afford the rent there. I mean, the rent there was out of this world expensive because it was this tourist attraction. So yeah, we just lived in a cave. And we ended up almost living there for 2 months, which is pretty funny. Yeah, it was like a month and 3 weeks in the end. By the time we finally left, we had a couple roommates, but they were like, we had a couple rats that were living in there and there was a couple other little critters, but nothing ever messed with us. It was awesome. We had a great, great sea view. You could see the sea from where we were. Oh, we had a hammock set up outside and it was plus 40 outside. It was ridiculously hot this August. It was crazy. But in the cave, it was cooler, which was nice. It was cooler.
Nice.
So that was helpful.
That's awesome.
I couldn't believe we were living in a cave though. It was probably one of the craziest things. When we started telling, like when I had posted on Instagram that we were there and some of my friends from back home were like, are you actually living in that cave? Like, are you still living in that cave? Like it was pretty funny. It was really, really funny. It was cool to be a caveman for a while. It, you know, gets you back to your roots, gets you back to wherever you're going now. And so then at this point, at this current moment, we're riding back up. So we biked all the way down Italy and now we're just biking all the way back up.
And what's the plans when you get back up to the north?
When we get back to the top, that's when I keep saying it, like speriamo. So like, let's hope that everything opens this time, that it's allowed to be open. Mm-hmm. And we're still waiting on this permesso di soggiorno, which is pretty funny. We're still waiting on all that. If all of these moving parts work together, it should just end up that we're going to go back up to Champoulec and we've got the same apartment again, which is really cool. We've got our apartment back. We're just going to go to work and just do a normal winter season here in Italy. And I guess during the whole time I've been working on, I got into photography.
Yeah, this was something I was going to ask you about because I've seen your pictures on the Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you get into that?
Because I didn't really have much else to do during the pandemic when I was in Canada. And my little brother had been doing it for a little while. And I had made a lot of friends through the snowboarding world that were taking photos. And I've got a certain look to me with this large red beard and mostly that. And I've had a lot of pictures taken of me. And it was kind of funny because a lot of the snowboarding stuff and everything was me in the picture. I like that. It's cool. It was sweet, but I don't know. I've just never really pictured myself as being like a model of any kind. So I thought to myself, maybe I'll learn how to take the pictures and then I can do both and have more variety to this package and try to basically see where it can lead.
Yeah. Nice.
So I just grabbed a camera. My brother had two. So he had just bought a new one. So I took his old one. Got a couple more lenses for it and a computer to do the editing and stuff like that. And I just basically just got onto the internet like I always do and asked Google, how do you learn how to do photography? But yeah, anyways. So yeah, we're biking now. We left the cave. We're biking. We've been staying in abandoned buildings here and there because it's been raining a lot this time, which is really unfortunate. Really takes away from morale. But it's been great because there's lots of abandoned buildings in Italy. So we're just, anytime it rains, you put the tent in the building and boom, done.
How do you find these abandoned buildings? Are you just going past them and going, oh, there's one? Or are you actually looking them up? Is it actually?
Exactly like that. Exactly like that. But, oh, it's around 5:30. Sun's going to be going down pretty soon. Let's start looking for a building. And probably 10 minutes later, there's one. right there. There's one. There's another one. So we got super lucky with some of them, like the old rustic Pugliese, like the Trullo, like mm-hmm. the actual Trullo, like those cone-shaped houses made of only stone. Wow, that was a great experience sleeping in one of those ones. That was really cool. But then when we got into the really like abandoned house kind of looking ones, that's mm-hmm. when I realized this, like, we're squatters. This is what this is. This is what people call squatting, is when you stay in other people's abandoned houses. But yeah. we're gone by 6 o'clock in the morning anyway. We're gone. So it's whatever. Maybe it's not legal. Maybe it is. Who knows? But you have to catch me first. So,
well, we won't tell anyone where you are. It's fine.
Somewhere in Italy, in any of their abandoned buildings. Good luck.
In any abandoned building or cave. Cody the fugitive.
Not my fault. I'm still waiting for my residence permit. Come on.
Exactly. There we go. So you're heading back up north now?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I've been through this whole time. We've just been working on documenting this trip. It's interesting. We're calling it Two Bikes, and it's telling a story through my camera and also Bonnie's journal. She's done an absolutely fantastic job of journaling throughout this entire time. Mm-hmm. And doing this photography thing, I want to try and make the lifestyle that I'm leading right now sustainable. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be able to find ways to not work so hard, to have my own time, to be able to do a month of bike touring and then another yeah. month of bike touring, all this stuff. Because I don't think I would have been able to do it if I was still working a full-time position.
No.
Where I needed to report to somebody else, or I needed to do any of these things. And yeah, there's lots of things that you can do. You can start a business. You can sell things on the internet. You can do a lot of different stuff. But mm-hmm. I've learned how to do photography. I understand marketing relatively well. And I've found kind of a creative outlet. And it's fun. So we're basically going to try and publish it into a large format book and then maybe bring it into some galleries. And the cool thing was is that I actually got a commissioned project now. Somebody has fronted us some money to do another project, and we're calling this one 1200 Runs. And it's kind of a similar idea of what you're doing, is just trying to expose and tell people about what season life really is.
Oh, cool.
Instead of just taking photos of people doing awesome snowboarding, I might take some photos of that, but also photos of people passed out on a couch or
living in a cave,
working out of a box. We're living in a cave. It's a couple of things that we're working on right now.
That's cool. Well, I'm going to move on to all the other questions that I kind of ask everyone. From your experiences of the visa application processes that you've had to do, do you have any tips for anyone out there? Is there anything that stands out that you wish you had known before?
Give yourself a lot of time. I think that's probably one of the best advice that I can always give people, is like, don't leave it to the last minute. Like, just start your applications, get these things going. They take a long time to expire. So don't worry if you're like 2 weeks too early or anything like that. Just like get your stuff organized and then you'll be all right. You'll be okay.
If someone was only planning to do one season, where would you recommend them to go and why?
Yeah, the old one season thing. From my experience, it might be a little bit biased because I've spent so much time there. If you want to go do a winter season, you should probably go to Japan. Because like, it's a country that it's first world country, but I call it the Wild West of first world countries, really. Like it's an interesting place. It's got a culture of its own. And a lot of the places, like you can go to Australia, you can go to Canada, you can go to the places in the north of Europe. I don't want to say this as a broad statement because I'm sure everybody can find different opinions on this kind of thing, but a lot of these first world countries are all similar in the way that they operate. You know what I mean? Like, especially if you want to talk about Commonwealth countries, we're very similar in the way that we think. Maybe our accents are different and stuff like that. But if you want a really interesting culture shock, you should go to Japan. First of all, the snow is incredible. It's deep and it's fun and it's just an incredible experience. And the tree skiing is different because it's not conifers, it's deciduous trees. So that's really cool. And then, yeah, the culture is amazing. The food's incredible. The people are hilarious. It just goes on and on. If you like hot water, the onsens are amazing. You can find mud onsens. You can find all sorts of different crazy things yeah. out there. It's cool. It's really, really cool. I would always suggest Japan.
Yeah.
Good place.
What was your best job and what was your worst job and why?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, My best job? I think that my best job has always been bartending, just because I just love it. It's so much fun. You get to talk to so many people on a level where you're selling them what they want already. Like they're coming to me asking me to make them what they already want, and then I can just keep selling them what they already want. Like, it's incredible. It's amazing. That's exactly what you want to be doing. And you're sitting there at the bar and you're talking to people about all sorts of different things. And sometimes you get to be the stranger that they're telling all their wild and fantastic stories to, because they feel like you're going to be like, you don't know them. So you're not going to know anything about them. So you hear these strange things about people. And it's good. I think that's probably always been my favorite job. I've had a lot of really fun jobs, but that has definitely been my favorite so far.
Cool.
My least favorite job was not done when I was in a ski season, actually. It was working door-to-door sales for a natural gas company in Winnipeg. That was tough.
Yeah.
That was hard. That was really, really, really hard. But it was an incredible lesson. Mm-hmm. I'll say it was my least favorite job, but I learned a lot in a short amount of time doing that job.
I can imagine.
A lot. Oh my goodness.
Sounds awful.
Don't recommend. Especially not in the winter.
Overall, where is the best place you've ever visited?
Gina, that is an incredibly difficult question. That is an incredibly difficult question. The best place that I've ever visited? I don't think I could possibly answer that question. To be honest, like I hate to say that. Like there's just so much cool shit around here. Like even just yesterday I was looking at some cool stuff. There's always something that's gonna be able to get you going. Like from the volcanoes that you can see out in Japan and all these and the monkeys in the trees that are in the snow, and then you get to go to Australia and see kangaroos jumping across a thin lake of water, like stuff you'd see in like the Lion King, but not in Africa, like in Australia. That's nuts. That's nuts. Even going to like the center of Canada, the very middle in the dead of winter, it's freaking cold, like minus 40 degrees out there. And if you look up at the night sky on a clear night sky, when it's minus 40 in the middle of winter, you'll just see some of the craziest stars and northern lights and crazy things that you can't even imagine. And it only for some reason works like that when it's bitter cold. Mm-hmm. But like, there's no possible way. Coming here to Italy, the people and the structures and the history and like,
yeah.
It's just too much. My mind is instantly overflowing with how much overflowing it is, you know? Yeah, everywhere is cool. There's always cool things to find anywhere that you go. But yeah, just like, I don't know, everywhere, the world. This earth has been the favorite place I've ever visited. It's an amazing place.
That's a good answer. I like that.
If I had to narrow it down to one,
Yeah, the earth. What do you prefer? I think this one goes without saying, but what do you prefer, winter or summer?
Oh man, Gina. I love winter so much. It doesn't even make any sense. It doesn't make sense. There's so many things to like about winter. There's the high contrast of the snow and the other stuff. Like that's not so white. That's incredible. There's no bugs. There's not so much sun burning you all the time. I mean, I might be biased because I got this white skin, but man, I love to have it as covered up as possible. So I don't have to soak myself in sunscreen. That's always nice. Yeah, I'm definitely like through and through a winter guy. I've spent a good amount of time in one of the hottest places in Italy. To give it a good shot, it's too much. It's too hot.
Where was your favorite season and why?
There's got to be something about the first season that you ever do. It's just so crazy how different it is to what you ever imagined life could have possibly been on the other side of the ski resort world, you know? Like, I'd been to a lot of ski resorts, a lot in Canada. And you're always the tourist, you know? You mean you're the paying customer. Mm-hmm. You're the person going there to buy the services, to eat at the bar, to rent the snowboards, to whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff. When you get to be on the other side of it for the first time, it's like it blew my mind. I just had no idea how much was going on behind the scenes, you know what I mean? And how often some of the people that were cooking my burger that I spent $10 for were wasted back there. Like, the stuff that you hear about, it's like, oh man, how do these ski resorts even run? How do they even run? It's amazing. My first season, Gina, I was with some of these really cool people working at this rental shop. And these two guys in particular, Alex Jupp and Michael Thompson, 2 days before New Year's, I think it was around that time. And we were all kind of having a bit of a chat and having some drinks in our common area of our staff accommodation. And our lodge manager, he already didn't like us very much because we were too loud and we were too rowdy. And we had an early quiet time of 10 o'clock and I was losing my brains because I was just like, I came here for an experience. Like, I didn't just come here to be quiet. I came here for all of this. You know what I mean? Like, this is part of the fun. I'm like, I work till 9. I want to hang out. So it's like, in good Canadian fashion, I thought to myself, why don't we go outside and build an igloo? Because if we can just build an igloo, it's quiet because it's soundproof. It's warm because it's a freaking igloo. And we can hang out there and drink all night. It doesn't matter. Nobody's going to get mad at us. So we go out there with a whole bunch of us. And like at first, there was a whole bunch of people excited about this idea because, I mean, nobody's ever built an igloo before. I will admit it wasn't an actual igloo made of blocks where you've got like that nice perfect shape. It was more of like a Quincy or a snow cave. You know what I mean? You're just in a pile of snow to make a cave. Oh, man. This gets so out of hand. So we started this project. And it was 2 days before New Year's. We ended up digging up this little hole. It wasn't anything big. And we had a little bit of a collapse because I hadn't done much research since I was a child on how to do this. So it wasn't working very well. And a lot of people kind of lost the steam and the motivation to do this. Mm-hmm. But Michael Thompson and Alex Jupp and myself were determined to make this little party room of ours. So we ended up digging this thing. And it was, I don't know, big enough for like 8 people or something like that. It was a reasonable size. We kind of like
That's
dug in
big,
a little bit.
Yeah.
It was a reasonable size. And a few days later after New Year's, the one person was having a birthday and he wanted to have his birthday party or a pregame kind of thing in this igloo. So we did that. And it was full of people. Like there was like, I don't know, 15 people stuffed inside of this tiny little thing. And we're just like, nah, we need to make this thing way bigger. This is not working. We started digging this thing out. And I mean, this was my first season. So I was trying to just do everything. I mean, we were going out, we were snowboarding every day, we were working. But then after work, we'd come back at 9 o'clock at night, put on some head torches and just go digging. And I mean, this was the season where we had unlimited building resources because it was snowing every freaking day. So
oh
we just
God.
Kept digging and kept piling snow and kept digging and kept piling snow and kept digging. And we got it to be pretty big. Like it had like 2 rooms and
what?
And like fair size. And then this other girl, Holly, said she wanted to have her party there. So then we had her party there. And this time it was a bigger party, but there was even more people. So there was even more stuffed. Again, it was way too full. It was like 30 people or something that were there.
Oh my
way
God.
Too full. You couldn't move. You couldn't. It was too small. It was super hot because there was that much body heat. So we thought, we got to make it bigger. We got to make it bigger. We ended up digging in this thing for like a month, every day, me and these two other guys, plus a lot of other volunteers, tons of other people would come help us from time to time because it got cooler and cooler and cooler the longer this thing kept going. And it ended up, we made this thing big enough, Gina. It was huge. It was called the glue. We gave it a name. It was called the glue. And it was actually got so much internet traffic that it's on Google Maps. Like it's on Google Maps. The glue Niseko is there, even though it's melted years ago, but there's a little pin in there that says that it's there, which is really hilarious. We had a party there that was, I don't know, 150 people.
What?
Probably like 100 and something inside. Like we had rooms and a DJ booth there. We ran extension leads under the snow from our accommodation to run DJ and speakers. It was insane. It was nuts. We had so many parties there. And I got in so much trouble, Gina, so much. I almost got fired. I almost got there was so much trouble.
Why?
I don't even know why it was all my fault, but I guess I was just the easy to blame front man for the whole thing. So I got a lot of flack. Anyways, it was amazing. It was amazing. And you know how at the end of the year, there's sometimes like those awards for like, I don't know, best bartender or best stack or best skier. You know, all these different things that kind of go around.
there's one for best bar. And Wild Bill's had won that award for like 8 years. Well, this year, we won it. The glue. The glue. And we weren't even a bar. One of the biggest parties that we had there, we had people that weren't even our friends that were showing up. And they're like, where do we buy alcohol here, man? I was like, you don't. It's just a party. We're not selling alcohol here. What are you talking about?
Oh, that's so cool. That is awesome.
It was amazing. It was really amazing. So I'll have to send you some pictures of it. It was crazy. I think it took like over 2 months. This whole thing happened and I think it ended in March. The last party was in March. It was amazing. So yeah, I'd say my first season, if I had to pick one, I loved them all, but yeah. I'd have to say that one was definitely memorable.
Where is your favorite place to snowboard?
That's a tough question, actually, because I've had a lot of really, really, really good experiences everywhere around the world. But the funny thing is the best days I've ever had snowboarding have been in Canada, actually. The mountains are really big. The mountains are huge in Canada. There's a lot of skiable terrain. And I have a lot more skill now than I did when I first left because I've been doing a lot of snowboarding. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think the best place to snowboard, in my opinion, humble opinion, would be Canada. And I've always said too, like, you know, that first time thing we were talking about with the seasons. Mm-hmm. I've always said that one of my favorite things about riding in resorts once in a while is when you go to a resort for the first time and you're like at the bottom and you're taking the first chairlift and you don't know what's around every turn and you look at the trail map and you mm-hmm. have no idea where all of these things go. And I think that's pretty cool because you can never do the resort the first time ever again. You know what I mean? Like you only are not going to know what's around that next turn once.
In your opinion, what is the best thing about season life or being a seasonaire in general?
The community, hand down. Just the community. It's the best. I spent a lot of time when I was younger, basically searching for, I guess, like that sense of belonging and like that real sense of being a part of something bigger. And I mean, I never really played in team sports when I was a kid and I was a little bit more frail and I was a redhead. So, I mean, that comes with all of its own complications. But when I was living in cities and working in those corporate lives, I felt that you'd have your own group of friends types of things, but you wouldn't necessarily expand past that very often. You know what I mean? And it would stay relatively closed. And sometimes new things would happen. But for the most part, like you'd be in a city of a million people, but yet most people are a stranger.
Yeah.
When I first got to these ski resorts, and what I started to notice was just like, everybody knows each other. And everybody goes to bat for each other. And mm-hmm. everybody really communicates, even if they're not from the same place. Like these are people from all over the world and they travel all over the world to go do this. And that common interest that everybody has of the mountains and everything that's around it, it really brings people together. I'd say that's my absolute favorite part. It's just that really warm sense of belonging and being a part of a group of people that like each other. And that's neat.
Yeah. Can you tell us about a challenge or difficulty you faced during your season air journey and what did you learn from it?
I ran out of money.
Ooh, that's a big one.
I ran out of money. I ran out of money a couple times, which was pretty funny. It's just like when I first left for Japan, I had, I don't know, like $3,000 maybe. I think probably less, to be honest. You don't get paid for your first month in Japan because it's paid monthly. So like you're not getting paid the first month. Yeah, I just ran out of money. I ran out of money a couple times. And it was sometimes things out of my control. Sometimes it was things very much within my control. And I think it was a huge lesson. It was a huge lesson in learning how to budget properly. It was a huge lesson in learning that, I guess, when I was working corporate, I had a very regular amount of money coming in. I was also making more money back then as I was once I changed my career path. You know what I mean? I was making more money back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then when I was working in Canada, I was working as a bartender on the west side of Canada. And I mean, tips in Canada are really good. And if you're working in a good restaurant with a lot of people in it, you're making good money. You get used to making a decent amount of cash. Mm-hmm. So then when I went out to these places like Japan or Australia is a bit different, but going to Japan or here in Italy, pay rates aren't that high. And you have to kind of relearn how to live with a little less.
Yeah.
But running out of money was definitely one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because it's really taught me yet again, even if it happened to me when I was in uni, but I was too young to really take the lesson. Mm-hmm. But you ask some friends, they kind of help you out of your situation, then you pay everybody back and you get back on your feet. But now you have better habits and you know what to avoid, and you know to avoid spending money on silly things, and you spend more time going to the grocery store and buying your food instead of getting somebody to cook it for you, which ends up actually making you healthier because you end up having a better diet. And the list goes on and on and on and on. But like, being able to live with much less is the only reason that I can even live my lifestyle that I have today. Mm-hmm. I mean, being here in Italy, I haven't worked in 10 months or paid work, really. I mean, a little bit here and there, like picking grapes and some photography, some of the stuff, but nothing that anybody would consider work. Especially not a regular amount of income that most people deal with. But because of the fact that I've run out of money before, I know how to live with very little. And being able to do that, shit, we've traveled this entire country all on the savings that I came here with, which wasn't that much, you know?
Yeah, that's so cool.
That was a good lesson, but that was a big mistake. And it was very difficult and embarrassing.
Were there any points in your journey where you thought, I should go home now? I've done my season thing. Maybe I should go home. You know, the whole societal pressure. Did that ever cross your mind, or were you just living the dream?
Well, it did the first time, but like, it didn't last long. It really didn't, because the longer I thought about it, the more I was like, I'm not being irresponsible. Like, I'm not doing anything wrong. Just because I'm not living the same life that a lot of other people, a lot of other consumers have been doing, doesn't mean that I'm doing anything wrong.
What's one thing you wish you had known before going on your first season?
I hate to say it about money, but just don't spend too much money on silly things. Don't drink all your paychecks away. Like, I know it's fun, but don't do that. Like, try to find a balance, or at very least just go buy a bottle somewhere else and drink it in the parking lot and go back inside the bar. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of ways to be able to do these kind of things, but that was something I think I wish I'd known before I'd first started. Just have a little bit of self-control. Mm-hmm. And also remember to sleep. That's an important thing. I wish I would have known that a little bit more. I'm still working on teaching myself that one, is remember to sleep.
Are there any opportunities that stand out to you that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't have gone and started working seasons?
My entire life, starting from November 2017, would not have happened if I wouldn't have left Canada. Everything that has happened to me from that decision, when I finally went to Japan and met all these people, and like, it's just been a snowball of different experiences, from the first one all the way to biking around Italy and like, at this point, I think we've cycled 3,500 kilometers in total. Like, I would have never done any of this, none of it, because I wouldn't have even known that any of this was a possibility. I wasn't in the right circle of people.
Yeah.
I kind of say this once in a while. It's like, you have a circle of people that are around you, and you can bounce ideas off these people, and everybody kind of brings up new things to the table. But if that circle never changes, your ideas and your like, even capacity to understand other ideas never really grows much, or not as easy. But when you insert yourself into other circles of people, all of a sudden you have these different points of view and these different experiences and these different collective experiences of all those people that give you opportunities that you've never had before.
Yeah.
And I know full well that my life would look nothing like it does today if I wouldn't have gone on this journey. Like, the igloo, the person that I met that is my partner now, Bonnie, like these crazy stories, these bike trips, this snowboarding all over the world, like hiking into Yote, the volcano, and snowboarding into the crater. Like, none of that would have happened in Canada.
Throughout all your travels, which place feels most like home?
I'd have to say that Italy feels most like home. In my description of home, when I went to Japan, I never actually learned much Japanese, so I missed out on half the conversation. As far as I'm concerned, I didn't get to hear everything else that was happening around me. So when I came here to Italy, I decided to actually put a lot of effort into learning Italian. Mm-hmm. And being able to speak the language here and communicate with local people and feel the community that I talked about in like the winter community, That sense of community very much exists here in Italy, especially in the South. And it's amazing because the way that I would kind of describe feeling like you're at home is feeling like you're comfortable, feeling like there's people you can depend on, feeling like you can find help if you needed it. And I've been here for a long time now. This is the longest single journey that I've done for a while. And if it all works out, I should probably be here for another year after this. So yeah, this definitely feels most like home. It doesn't feel anything like Canada, but it feels like home.
Awesome. When you're away, what is the thing you miss most about Canada?
So I'd say the thing that I missed most about being in Canada was my family. Because of the fact that I'm so close to my family. I grew up in the middle of nowhere on a farm with my brothers and my mom and dad. And I spent all of my time in my youth with my two brothers and my mom and dad. That's just what we did. And that's how we were. And my brothers, to this day, I can still say that my brothers are my best friends. And I could ask them anything. I could talk to them about anything. And as much as like, I really, really love these guys, I also know that we all have our own lives. They're all doing their own things. And we all understand that about each other too. But that doesn't mean I don't miss them. I definitely do. I miss being able to have those day-to-day chats, you know, and like having those day-to-day experiences, like the simple stuff with your family and friends, you know, like not the big, huge adventures like that you can have with anybody.
Yeah.
But just like, I don't know, having coffee in the morning and talking about nothing.
Yeah.
That's nice. And that's what I miss. My parents, my brothers, everybody, even when I said I wanted to quit my job and quit my career, like they were like, you just got to do what makes you happy. Mm-hmm. If it's not making you happy, get out of there. Like go do something else. And I've been incredibly fortunate that they have always been so, so supportive.
If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
You know what? If I had to go back and give myself some serious advice, just don't block off too many opportunities. You know what I mean? Like, don't just say no to things before really giving it a good thought. Mm-hmm. Like, often I found that I would push away things because either they were inconvenient or I was scared. There was 150 different excuses that could come to your mind as to why you don't want to change status quo. And that is one of the things that I definitely wish I knew more back in the day. But I mean, it's difficult to even say that because I wouldn't be who I am today if I haven't gone through everything that I've gone through in the past.
Yeah.
So I can't say that I would want myself to change too much because I don't even know what path I'd be on. And I quite like the one that I'm on right now.
Yeah.
I don't know. That'd be kind of nice to know. Maybe I would have done some other weird things. Who knows? But yeah, just don't say no to so much stuff. That would have been good advice.
Yeah. And on the topic of advice, what is the best piece of advice you have ever received?
Oh, one that's always stuck with me is something my dad told me, and he told me this lots. It's smile at the world and the world will smile back at you. Mm-hmm. And it's applicable in so many profound and also not profound and incredibly simple ways.
Yeah.
But I've just honestly found that it's true. The power of positivity is incredibly good. You can really help yourself along a lot if you just smile at a situation instead of the ulterior or the other side of it, which is, I don't know, getting angry or getting sad or getting upset. You can always kind of find some positivity in just about everything. Mm-hmm. I think that has been the best advice I've ever got. Because it's helped.
Yeah, really good advice. What's the worst piece of advice you've ever received?
You should get a credit card.
That's a good one.
That's the worst piece of advice I've ever received, ever. It's going to help you build good credit, they said. It's going to help that. What the hell do I need credit for if I don't want any loans? I don't know. It was bonkers. Absolutely bonkers. I don't know. A lot of stupid advice out there, but one mostly credit cards. Mostly credit cards.
Okay. Yeah. We talk a lot about mentors on the show, and it first came up on Lauren's podcast on episode one. But did you have any mentors who helped you along the way?
So I'd say it's an interesting question. Like I honestly couldn't pinpoint it down to one person because I have learned so much from so many people, from the first people that I met when I went to Japan, to some of the employers that I had, like Mami-chan and Koji and some of my friends like Evan and Jimmy. And like, I could just go on and on and on and on and on, because these people have taught me just a whole different way to live. Mm-hmm. I've learned things from the people that I'd be sitting on the chairlift with. I've learned things from people that I'd been sitting at the bar with. Like, this is what I talk about in like this sense of community. Like, if I wanted to say that there was a mentor, it would be this whole winter community, this whole season air community. As an entity itself has been an incredible mentor for me.
Yeah.
Because it's shown me that you can do what you like and still make a living. You can live in the mountains. You can ride 100 days a year. You can do all these different things that I always thought were impossible. I thought that a lot of this stuff just was completely out of my reach. Back in the day, I thought the only way that I could ever possibly have this is if I made so much money that I could buy a house in the mountains and also afford not to work for 4 months and then be able to do it. But in fact, the exact opposite happened. I needed to make so much less money. And now I get to go live in these fantastic mountains and get to snowboard every day. So the mentor has been the entire group of people that I got to share these experiences with, without a doubt.
Yeah. Obviously, earlier you were saying about the advice that your dad gave you about smile at the world and the world smiles back at you. Do you have any quotes or sayings that you live by?
That is one of them. There's another one I have tattooed on my arm and it says, do it anyway, because I needed to remind myself of that one often enough. Like I said, that was the piece of advice that I go back to my younger self to change things. It's just like, when opportunities come your way or something seems a little bit too difficult or a little bit inconvenient or a little bit, I don't know, like, I don't want to go snowboarding today, or I don't want to go do that 5K walk, or I don't want to go, I don't know, maybe just do like 10 squats in the morning. Mm-hmm. Just do it anyway, because it's probably going to help you out in the end. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of things that could help you. And I'm not saying I don't want to go do meth, so you should go do meth. Like, that's not like, don't take it out of context. We're talking about positivity here. But like, that's the advice that I would give people, you know, like, take some chances, go do some things. And like, worst comes to worst, you can always go back to work. Everybody could always go back to work. People do it when they're 65. I guarantee you can do it when you're 20. So go do something else for a little while. That's what I think.
Yeah. Perfect. Do you have any books, movies, publications, or anything like that you can recommend to our listeners, which helped you on your path?
I have two really good books that I think are excellent. Well, three if you want to learn about sleep. But the first two are How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Fantastic book. I know that it's been around for years and years and years, but it is incredibly relevant, in my opinion, on just learning how to be a decent human being. Or maybe not just a decent, but an agreeable human being, which is helpful.
Yeah.
Really helpful in life to be able to talk to people and not insult them all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's getting easier and easier nowadays. It really is. So if you can have the tools to be able to, you know, stay on most people's good books, that's good stuff. How to Win Friends and Influence People, I think, is a fantastic book. Another one, which I think actually might be even more fantastic, is called Crucial Conversations. And I'm no good at remembering who all, like, I did remember the Dale Carnegie one because, I mean, it's a simple name and I hear it all the time. This other one, I can't remember who wrote it, but I could send it to you. But Crucial Conversations. It is literally a book about difficult conversations. It's a book that talks to you about what happens in your brain when you're faced with a difficult conversation, what can happen between the two people, what types of problems you can run into, what types of things that you can... It just helps you become a more effective communicator and to be able to bring up tough things effectively and gracefully. It's been a life-changing book, to be honest. It's really, really, really helped. It's really helped.
Sold.
Sold.
What is one myth about season air life that you would like to debunk?
I don't even know. I don't even really know what many of the myths were. I really don't even know what the myths were. Like, it was, always, I guess, you know what? It's not always a party. I can actually say that. It is not always a party, because if you want to get the most that you can out of these things, you have to balance yourself. You have to find balance. Like, this is in my opinion. Like, I know that there's people that can burn candles at both ends, and I was one of them, but you don't remember anything. So it's like, it isn't always a party. I think that it's a lot more than that. It's learning and it's growing and it's working and and it's experiencing all these different things. It's not just a bunch of people getting fucked up all the time. It's more than that. So if that is a myth, I'd like to debunk it. It's so much more than just drinking. You can do that anywhere. You can party anywhere.
So now I have to ask you my mom's favorite question. What's one thing you take with you everywhere you travel, or do you have any travel hacks?
Something that I do take everywhere that I travel is a Bluetooth speaker. I like to be able to put music on in all of the different places that I sit down for a little while. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if I've got an apartment or a cave or an abandoned house, nothing makes it feel more like home than some nice music playing in the background when you're making yourself some dinner. So that's definitely something that I bring everywhere. It's awesome. Travel hacks though. Travel hacks. Try your very best to book your flights directly through the airline because it saves you a lot of problems when it comes time to make changes when you're at the gate and things are really rushed and now you have to wait for Expedia or whoever the hell else to fix it for you. No, much easier if you just book it with the airline. You can even find the price online and then call the airline and be like, hey, I found this price over here. Can you give it to me for that price? And they'll probably say yes.
Yeah.
And then at least that way you have somebody that can help you. So that's a good travel hack, I think. That's a good one.
Awesome hack.
We've learned that lesson. Bonnie and myself have learned that lesson multiple times. So don't be like me. Book it through the airline. You had a company one time, a third party company, like the ones that are selling this, go bankrupt. And she didn't hear about it until she was at the gate with this ticket. Everything was all printed. Everything was fine. And they're like, well, the company went bankrupt. So you actually don't have a seat on the flight.
Oh my God.
And she had to buy another seat then and there for way more money. Yeah. Crazy.
That's not cool.
Crazy. And try to get money back from a bankrupt company. That's a process.
If you hadn't gone and done your first season, what do you think you'll be doing right now?
I probably would be working at a HR job in a casino, which is really funny. Because it was a opportunity that was given to me right before I left. And it was very, very close to being hired into this HR director position. And then I wasn't going to get that. And then I was going to be hired right underneath that person.
Right.
And that was the plan. And basically, I left. And then when I came back, he's like, so what do you think? I was like, I'm not going to come back. So that's probably what I'd be doing. I'd be working over there.
So we're getting to the end of the chat now, but there's a few more questions to go. Every guest nominates a couple of people to come on and have a chat with me. Is there anyone you would like to nominate to come on and speak to me?
Yeah, I would actually. So one of the guys, his name is Josh Wilson. He is the one I was talking to you about that I was working with in Japan in Nozawa Onsen, actually. And he's got a couple different things that he had started out there. He started with a burger shop and kind of went from there. And now it's really expanded a lot. So I feel like he would be an incredible guy to talk to. And it's really interesting because he's not like this guy that's got a lot of social media and a lot of all this other stuff. He's a little bit off that side of things. So
Okay. Really
cool dude. And then on the exact opposite scale is a good friend of mine, Evan Wilcox, guy that I met in Niseko. He's an American that's been living out there for quite some time now And basically made his life working in these winter seasons. Fantastic guy, super charismatic, lots of funny stuff to talk about. Great dude. And the last would be Jess Kibbs. I met her in Australia. She'd been doing lots of winter seasons, also summer seasons in the United States. Her and her fiance are kind of van lifing through the United States right now, working all sorts of different types of jobs. And yeah, I think that she'd be a pretty cool person to talk to as well.
Yeah, for sure. Is there anything that you would like to tell our listeners about, any projects you're working on that you want to go into in a little bit more detail?
I'm taking photos right now and trying to be a lot more creative and make some cool storybooks out of it and essentially tell people about what we've been doing and what I've been doing. Yeah, keep an eye out for it because it's coming. it's coming, regardless of if you want it or not. It's coming anyway.
Whereabouts can people find you?
Probably on Instagram would be the best place to find me, Cody Chef. Otherwise, just come find me. Come bike with me. Come look for me in one of these abandoned houses or climb a mountain or something. That's the best place to find me.
It's the most fun, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And what's next for Cody and Bonnie then?
What's next is going up and doing this winter season up in Italy, making sure that everything works out. But everything always works out, so I think it'll work out. After that, I don't know, we've got a couple different plans. One option is perhaps to go down to South America to kind of keep doing this winter season flip-floppy thing, as long as it becomes easier to fly. And it's all kind of pandemic depending. But the other idea is actually maybe to bike all the way to Central Asia. So it's this place called Kyrgyzstan. There's some big mountains over there, and it's like 6,000 or 7,000 kilometers away from Italy. So it would take a long time to bike there, but we'd get there in time for the next winter. So
yeah, that sounds incredible.
That's an idea. The more I bike, the more I want to do it.
This has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
I had an absolute blast doing this, and I appreciate your patience in my internet connection and my strange face light thing that looks like I'm from that Blair Witch Project all the whole time. Thank you so much, Gina. I appreciate
this. Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, hopefully we'll hear a bit more about your journey at a later date as well.
Sounds good. I love it.
That was awesome. Such an incredible guy with so much energy. Thanks again to the marvelous Cody Chef for coming on today's show. Don't forget to give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram, and remember to hit the subscribe button on your podcast player to get all new releases of the show as they come out. Once again, a big thank you to Mike at Mike's Sports Bar for the studio space. Thank you to Mondo Wave for the music, and thanks to you guys for tuning in. See you all again next time.
It's all true. The guy making your burger is wasted.